talking with David Edge in Edinburgh on 10th August, 76. Now, you began at Cambridge in 55 or something.
That's
like
right,
that,
it
I
would
believe.
Be October 55.
Yeah. And where were you an undergraduate before?
At
that?
Cambridge.
At Cambridge also, in physics?
In physics, yes.
Right. And how did you get connected with the radio astronomy group? How did that come around?
Well, I was doing part two physics, and in part two physics you had special topics which you took. And I took the geophysics and I took atmospheric physics. And there was also a series of very short series of lectures with Martin Ryle and others on radio astronomy, and I took that too.
Was this optional or did everybody?
Oh, optional. Well, you had to do some special topics from part of the paper, but you had a wide range of things. The point was I wasn't interested in solid-state physics or electron microscopy or nuclear physics or the fundamental or theoretical physics. And I wasn't interested in fluid dynamics, which were other things that were going. I had been interested in electronic techniques at school. I had made a television set out of a kit. I made one. Yeah. And I, in the RAF, had taught air wireless mechanics, and I enjoyed simple electromagnetic theory. So doing the atmospheric physics and the radio astronomy was a sort of extension of my interest in the electronic techniques. And the geophysics was one that was sort of broadly thought to be related to that. And so those are the special topics I took, and so I learned about the radio astronomy. And then what happened in those days in Cambridge was that Cavendish had about 14 or 15 DSIR studentships every year to give out, and they had somewhat less than 14 or 15 firsts each year. And so the first two or three or so of the 2-1s would get studentships. Now, I applied for a studentship, and when it was not known what my class was going to be, and it was thought, and I had a first in part one, I had a fair chance of getting a first in part two. In fact, I was one of three 2-1s who were offered studentships. There were, I think, 12 firsts and three 2-1s. So Ian Snowball and John Atkins and myself were the three 2-1s. And so they had 15 studentships. So I was then. Then the question was, where are you going to go? Mm-hmm. Now, I know, and John Law also discovered and put into his thesis, and it is so, that there were high status. I mean, the best people were the nuclear physics lot and the solid state physics people were after the best students, and one or two of the theorists as well. So that the best firsts were grabbed, and so they were disappeared into those holes. And then there was, I suppose, molecular biology as it became crystallography, and well, crystallography was fairly high status then too, and then that took from physics things. And there was radio astronomy, which were very much at the bottom of the tree. And so radio astronomy tended to get a chance. It's a little bit like the way basketball players are recruited in America.
I was a seventh round
draftee, and I went to radio astronomy. And I knew enough about it, and Martin Ryle was willing to take me.
But how did this come about? Why didn't someone like Ryle protest that he gets in?
Well, of course, it always was the case that there were every year good firsts who wanted to come to radio astronomy, but the way the visibility worked in the Cavendish, the prestige, people tended to think, I mean, we used to say at Cambridge that people would go to Harwell to make their little pile. I mean, that's a nasty joke, but I mean, you know, that was the time at which the nuclear energy program was expanding, and this is where the jobs and the apparent prestige.
So the students themselves wanted to go.
The students themselves perceived the important parts of physics being those that related to the nuclear program, and that's where a lot of the best people in my year went.
Now, would you have preferred to go there yourself?
No, yeah. I wasn't interested in that. Precisely why I wasn't interested, I don't know. I think it's partly because my lack of mathematics. I failed the advanced mathematics in my first year. They used to have a special subject for people who wanted to go towards the more mathematical parts of physics called advanced half-subject maths. And we had Hartree doing numerical methods and things of this kind. And I tried that in the first year, and I only got 60% in the thing, which wasn't good enough. 66% was cut, so I couldn't go on, though I went to the lectures. But I knew by then that my mathematical capacity wasn't up to the kind of work that went on in nuclear physics and theoretical parts of nuclear physics. On the other hand, it clearly was up to the electromagnetic theory. And the electromagnetic theory was presented to us very clearly, and I enjoyed it. Briggs lectured to us in the first year, I remember. He's the ionospheric chap, and it was very clear and good. And the problems he gave out in his first term, I tackled my first Christmas vacation. I discovered he made two errors in the results, you know, and I did them. And I felt then a sort of general competence growing in this area, which I've never actually quite lost, I think. But so the mathematics is necessary for that.
So you went into Ryle's group then happily?
Quite happy, no question about that.
And what did you work on in that first
year? Well, what happened was, I came, and the situation was that they'd finished the 2C survey, and it was just published. And they had, of course, been presenting it at meetings earlier in the year. And the plan always was, the plan for the instrument, the 2C, 3C instrument, was always that it was going to work at two frequencies. And the debate, I gather, before I came, was which one to do first. Mm-hmm. And they did the lower, the longer wavelength one, the lower frequency one, the longer wavelength one first, because they thought they knew, you know, the relative abundance of sources and the signal-to-noise and all the other parameters, that it would be not so confusion-limited as it turned out to be.
Right, but the advantage was to get more sources.
To get more sources, right. That's right. They thought. They wouldn't be limited by signal to noise, and they wanted more sources first, so they went for the first one. But it was always a question, they were going to do 160 megacycles as well. It was 81.5 for 2C. They were going to do 160 megacycles as well. So I came just at the point at which they were starting to convert. So my job was to help with the conversion, which meant putting extra reflecting wires on the paraboloids, putting up new aerials and making those out of copper wire. All the sorts of things one did of repainting the aerials and wire brushing them and all that kind of thing, and preparing new stabilized preamplifier power packs for the preamplifiers that were down little huts at the end of the range, and checking out the preamplifiers themselves.
And who was guiding you on this?
John Shakeshaft. John Shakeshaft had got his PhD on the 2C survey and had gained his reputation, and at that time the 2C survey hadn't really started to be criticized, and had got a fellowship to continue. Mm-hmm. Precisely, I think it was a college fellowship, but it might have been an RCI one. But anyway, he was going to be around for some time, so he'd become one of the group, and Martin had delegated to him the business of doing the conversion and setting up and doing the 3C survey. And although I was nominally supervised by Ryle, I was basically supervised by John S., whom I worked with very closely day by day. And we worked together and did changing jobs.
You mentioned to me before your one contact with Ryle's supervisor.
Well, supervision tended to be a rather odd affair. And in fact, this had its disadvantages. For instance, as soon as I got my first records off the 3C survey and my very first little clutch of radio stars with intensities, I was foolish enough to do a quick log N log S plot, which came out with exactly 1.5 slope, because I hadn't done anything about corrections for diameters, and I hadn't controlled for the distance from the galactic plane and various other things. And I was foolish enough, I went into Martin's office carrying it, thinking, you know, a supervisor would be interested, no. And he wasn't there, so I left it on the desk, and I discovered sometime later by an eruption, an explosion, furious. You know, what have you done? You haven't tried this, that, what does it mean? I discovered I shouldn't do that. So we didn't have enough contact all the time. And I was, I think Martin used to sort of get reassured through John S. that I was actually getting on with it. Mm-hmm. And he occasionally would drop into the office and see that I got records and was analysing. You see, what happened was the 2C survey, they analysed by actually getting... Well, how much do you know about how it worked? They had a declination setting. Well, you had pins, you tip the thing, and it was 2.5 degrees per tip, and you put these pins in. The Russians who visited us, Chikachev and Vitkovich came one time, and they were absolutely astonished at the rudimentary engineering. They said back home the engineers would take in and everything would be 10 times stronger than it ought to be. And they were absolutely astonished at the way we nipped up, and we would have one person tipping it, another one taking out a pin and putting in a new pin. So you tipped it 2.5 degrees. It used to take about 2 or 3 hours to tip the whole aerial, and it was a two-man job. And that was good fun. I used to enjoy shinning up and down that. It was a bit like, you know, sailing again. And we used to do, at each tip, you'd ended four cable phasings, so that you've got four declination positions of the centering of the interference pattern.
Right.
And for 2C survey, they just actually got physically the four records that you've got and lined them up and went along lining them up and looking for over those four actual records and extracting what looked like sources on the cards. And then they do the next four declination things, and then they put all the cards together and try to correlate them that way. Now, my view was that, I mean, the 2C survey records were so complicated that just looking over somebody's shoulder, you could see things everywhere. And the skill, as it were, which John Thompson in particular did a lot of this and developed, looked a little dicey. So I wondered whether you could correlate more than four at a time so that you got a tighter fit, so that you weren't, as it were, putting on cards hopeful sources and then hopefully correlating them with other cards. John Baldwin always used to say it was equivalent in terms of information theory, and probably was. But I reckoned you ought to try to get a whole range of records and look at them all together. And that meant tracing information off each thing onto a big sheet. So I remember going round to a local...
Superposing?
I'll explain.
Okay.
So I remember getting petty cash, a voucher, and going round on my bicycle to a local warehouse where they sold huge Formica sheets, and getting an immense white Formica sheet to put on, glue on top of my table, which I tried to cycle back with and got blown off the bike because it was such a large windage. And then going to the local art shop, and finding that they got tracing paper, graph paper, tracing paper, which were, I suppose, 2 feet, 3 feet wide, and I'm buying a number of these rolls. Mm-hmm. And I used to take a record and put the graph paper over it, and I then would trace onto it the positions of the major, of the major lobes, in fact, all the interference patterns, carefully putting on exactly, and lining it up and making calibration errors and doing all the things for sidereal time and lining it up. And then put in, I could, of course, measure the amplitude on the graph paper, and putting in every third lobe or so a figure which was a reading of the intensity of the amplitude at the time. And so I got, over time, these huge sheets which summarized the whole sky, the raw data in the whole sky. And Martin used to come in, and he would see, if I wasn't there, records piled up, and these huge graphs. He couldn't understand the shorthand I used. I mean, he used to peer at it. I had calibrating rulers and things for working out when you lobe shifted how big an intensity change you had to correct for, right, and so on. And I had this thing, it probably still sitting around the Cavendish somewhere, a strip in which I pasted it on, and I used it as a calibrating thing up there. And he couldn't understand any of this. He didn't bother to find out what shorthand I was using. So he peered at these sheets and couldn't see what was going on. I mean, he just knew something was happening.
He was willing to trust this because Shakespeare was...
Well, that's right. I mean, John was in the same room. He knew that I was working with
him. But John was not distrusting you. I mean,
John knew what I was doing. And although I don't think John himself would have been able to take over the analyzing thing and do precisely what I was doing, he knew that what I was doing was not stupid.
Right.
And one time I came in and Martin was poring over these and looking at this graph paper and obviously puzzled, and suddenly he lifted his eyes and said, "Nobody tells me what my research students are doing these days," and walked out, and that was my research supervision for the year. I can show you, I've got the thesis here. I have got some samples of the kind of thing we actually used. They are typical samples of the thesis. You'll see is fairly short. Here we are. Here's the kind of thing I did on the graph paper. This is a source. Here are the various readings at the declination positions.
Oh, yes.
And here are the positions of the main lobes. I used to put a line for the main lobes, and I used to dot the subsidiary lobes, so you get some idea of the periodicity. And then you see I've clustered it all together. I can make up a source out of this one and that one, and then I shift them down, lobe shifting, and here 15.4, 14.2, 16.5, 18.2 are the estimates corrected of the intensity.
Right.
And there you have the position, and I'd make up the position and the errors out of that.
I see.
And that's a clear one. I mean, that's one that came out with a red circle around it as an it looked as if it was unconfused. And then there are various others.
Are there some unclear ones that still went in the survey?
Oh, absolutely. Well, here is one, you see, where you've got a clear one down here. Very good. I mean, this is marvellous agreement. But there's something in here which is confused with it, and I've done a little bit of vector subtraction and got out a thing here and then moved it up here for a small one, which agrees pretty closely with the one down here, and that then got a different rating. And we used to put A and B in the catalogue. The A ones are the ones that looked clear and unconfused, and the B ones are ones that I had put together out of the bits and pieces after extracting the obvious ones.
Yes.
And this, I reckoned, was the best way, because you had as much of the raw material before your very eyes as you did it.
Was there a reliability criterion in the 2C survey, similar to ABC? Sort of,
well, there must have been, but I never discovered how they worked out whether the cards fitted or not. You had a set of cards from one declination.
But I mean, in the published record, did they talk about different classes of reliability?
They did. So,
In retrospect,
well, some of the very good-looking sources, like 3C275, on our records, which I think you'll find is an A-class source in the actual paper. Now, that turns out, as you know, to be a complicated one, and in fact wasn't simple.
Yeah.
But it looked simple. It was unresolved. Because the advantage of this four-declination settings thing is that it's not that you get increased resolving power. I used to have arguments over the concept of resolving power. I mean, to me, resolving power means the ability actually, you know, with the Gaussian curves, to separate and to see as separate two things. What you discover, what the extra information you get from the interference fringes within the lobe of the primary pattern is not necessarily a separation in the resolving power. What you discover is what would look simple to the simple area on its own, potentially, turns out to be complicated because the interference patterns are a complicated mess. But you don't get enough information to give a unique solution to the complicated mess. And so there's always, once you start piecing things together and pulling one out and trying to get something together out of the mush, you're leaving yourself wide open to the sorts of errors that can make really large things.
So
you can discover,
what you're saying is you cannot map it to that resolution, but you just get the information that there's more to it.
You get, that's right. So we thought it important to put down a B classification, which would say, we feel there is something here, it's about here, about this intensity, but our information tells us it's probably more complicated, and this is something worth putting in.
Now, after the fact, did in fact these B sources turn out to be less reliable?
Well, oh no. When in fact, actually, I haven't done in detail, but once they started checking out, there were less than 10% of the 3C sources that we put into the catalogue, was 10 to 15%. That turned out with the higher resolution work to be simply misleading. That is to say, if you took it to represent a fairly condensed source in that area, you wouldn't be misled.
This is 3CR, is it?
That's three. Well, the 3CR was the 3C corrected for that 10 to 15%, and the 10 to 15% figure comes from the first check with the 3C with the first of the 4C aerial run. I think they used 4C as a pencil beam instrument and the North Polar Survey, but they used it as a pencil beam first. They had to do it quickly to check it out in time for the first results to appear at the Paris Symposium. So at the Paris Symposium, the 3C results were produced. I wasn't allowed to go, by the way. I was too junior. But the 3C results were presented, and they might well have been chewed up in the way the 2C results were, but they've got 2 weeks, just or something like that, order, before the Paris Symposium. They just got enough runs to be able to provide some information to check it out and to check out the MSH, the Mills lot. And
was before 3C was published. Actually.
That was before 3C was published.
It was the first time it was presented.
The first time it was presented was at the Paris Symposium, that's right.
But it was possible
to give alongside the 3C a preliminary, very minor paper saying we have some further information independently from the new aerial, which checks out and which effectively said that the errors that I quoted errors of how many sources I thought would be found to be misleading, and of course there were errors of position and intensity. And the one thing that really pleases me about the reception of the 3C survey is that later work has shown all those error estimates to be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And they've not been seriously misleading. And as you know, a physicist is more pleased when his error estimates are checked than when his actual figures are taken.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You used the term radio stars. I don't know if it was inadvertently. What were you calling them in those days? Were you calling them radio sources or stars?
Well, the title of the thesis.
We survey of radio stars at 159 megahertz.
Yeah.
Is this indicative that indeed the galactic background was being mainly thought of as a...
Well, I never got involved in that discussion. By the time I was getting into the game, I think that idea had really faded away. You'll have to refer to my book. I mean, but one still talks about radio stars. One talks about radio stars.
A few extragalactic identifications.
Oh, sure. One talked about them, knowing it was a metaphorical use of star.
I see.
There was no doubt about it that by that time, and of course eventually by the Bakerian lecture, which we all had a hand in preparing, that we were fully convinced that they weren't stars. which is why I'm puzzled at some of the ways after I left that the Cambridge people responded to the very first quasar